everyone, welcome to the podcast. I'm joined in the studio, and when I say studio, I do mean kitchen, by, on my right, Alex. Hello.
Hey.
How you doing?
Good.
And,
how are you?
Yeah, I'm not bad. And on my left, Alistair. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Excellent.
Cool. So today we're going to be talking a bit about the state of the music industry. First, I thought, since it's quite a popular topic at the moment, we could talk about the X Factor. Do either of you watch The X Factor?
No.
Have you ever watched The X Factor?
I've watched it once or twice. It's been on in the room. But I aggressively don't watch it.
So do you sort of refuse to watch it? What's your opinion?
I wouldn't never choose to watch it. I'd watch it if I was like strapped down to a chair. Forced to.
Fair enough. Alex, do you watch it?
Mostly as when I'm in at my girlfriend's house. Her mother watches it. But yeah, like I wouldn't say no. I don't even watch it for the music at all. Just like the occasional talent that someone might have, and then the characters who are on it. But nowadays it's getting like all about the drama and the magazines behind it, who are all just hitting up different things that happen to the singers, different relationships that go on and stuff. None of it's about the music.
Yeah.
So I'm not like a fan, but I'd watch it. It's entertaining.
I watch it. I don't ever like the people that win. They never really do that much.
Yeah.
I really like Will Young, actually. He wasn't Egg Factor, he was Pop Idol or whatever, but
he's in Skins.
Yeah, he's done quite a lot
so
now.
Funny, yeah.
So last year, when, you know, every year the X Factor winner gets number one, and it's not very fair because their songs, in my opinion, are usually really rubbish, but they get Christmas number one. I really miss, like, I wish it could be Christmas every day and blah, blah, blah. But then, yeah, last year there was a Facebook campaign to get Rage Against the Machine a number one, and they won. Did either of you purchase?
I may have.
Myself also.
Yeah, so so I think we all purchased Killing in the Name of You.
It was like 79p or something, and you're just putting like 79p in for a single to like for a track on iTunes or Play.com or whatever.
And of course the irony
Sing it to the Man.
They were both owned by the same umbrella
organization. Yes, yeah. Both Simon Cowell to the top, but also he was like, I don't even care. So really, like, it was a very minor victory.
I know, and a lot of people were saying that the record label themselves actually started off, because then they obviously made a lot more money than they would.
That's possible, yeah.
I thought it was a shame, because obviously it was against Simon Cowell, but then Joe McElderry, like, he seems like a nice guy, and he was robbed of his number one. And
he was an innocent, like, because Cowell totally made, Simon Cowell made a big statement saying, you're basically making a victim out of Joe McElderry, because he just, like, basically worked pretty hard to win an amateur competition and won and was getting an opportunity to have a number one and like a hit single. Then basically, like, the way Cowell put it was that the public stole the number one place from him, just as kind of like salt in the wound of, oh, you don't have number one. We're also going to put in this song that you don't even like.
If the public stole the place from him, the public didn't want him to have the place.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Simon was saying morally, he's just a kid who worked really hard in this competition, and you guys are just denying him that, the fact that he can say I had number one. But really, he still sold absolutely. Like, he's won millions and then got number two.
But then,
so famous.
He deserved it after winning the competition, but then he done quite a bad cover of an already horrendous song by Miley Cyrus, so
yeah,
I don't know how much that song was deserving of Christmas number one, but never mind.
Totally. Yeah, nothing crispy going on there.
Do you think that the state of music today is a lot more manufactured than it used to be? Speaking of Miley Cyrus, she had, like, the Hannah Montana show and, like, this whole brand. Then, if you think about, like, the Monkees, they started on a TV show, didn't they? So,
like, I don't think it's, like, more manufactured, but I think the scale of the manufacturing is just, like, massive now. It envelopes so much more, like, just because they can pump much more money into it, so they can advertise it a lot more, so it's basically the same thing, because like with Monkees, there's some merchandise, a TV show, and then their music. And then with Miley Cyrus, there's the merchandise, her TV show, and the music, but there's so much money behind it now, that it's so much about making a profit that it's just a massive, now it's internationally, she's famous, regardless of the quality of her stuff, just because it's like a kid aspiration thing.
But then you've always had manufactured bands.
Yeah, I just mean it's the scale.
Even things like, as you said, the Monkees, or even Elvis. Elvis never wrote a song, he performed. He was cherry-picked by an officer he met in the military. He was created. He wasn't an organic star.
No, that's the thing. I agree with that. Because it's not that it's any more manufactured. It's just as manufactured. It is just the scale that's expanded. Because now it's just like, they've seen the opportunity to make all the money. and because there's so much money behind it now in the big studio, so they can just throw it in there and then make it really huge.
Yeah, I think the 90s were quite bad for like manufactured girl bands and boy bands that couldn't sing, couldn't write their own music, couldn't play any instruments. Yeah, but then I don't know, these days you did have that, but you've got a lot more like rock and bands that try to play instruments and stuff, which is always quite nice.
Like, I think there's still the space for all the smaller stuff. It's just that, I mean, the space is there, but the focus isn't on them. Because
mm-hmm.
the focus is just on all the chart stuff and all the manufacturing.
But to be honest, the kind of people who go after the chart stuff aren't the kind of people who tend to be interested in the smaller stuff anyway, so they're not exactly missing out on anything.
Yeah,
it's still about personal taste, and that still prevails.
So do you think things like being able to download music digitally has changed the chart? Like, do you guys still like to buy CDs, or do you download all your stuff online?
I buy CDs on special occasions.
To mention the CD,
if I download something that I really like, I would go out and buy a physical copy.
Huh.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't buy everything I listen to.
Yeah, no, I'm the exact same.
Yeah, I mostly go on ticket sales. Very occasionally, I will get the CD. But it depends if it's like my favourite band, if it's a new album, I'll definitely get that CD. I'll go to a shop and get it. But if it's something I hear is good, I'm not going to invest in, like, you know, a CD or anything like that. I'll just, like, download it. And then, if I really like it, then, yeah, I might in future get their CDs, or I'll just get tickets to go see them live if they play. And that's how I like to support them.
I think it depends how you listen to music, because if you only listen to music, like, on your computer and on your iPad, I don't have an iPad. on your iPod or your iPhone, then there isn't much point in buying a CD because it'll just get stuck on your shelf and you'll never use it. But then I drive around in my car a lot, and my car's got a CD player, so I listen to CDs more than a lot of people do. So I suppose it really depends. But then I quite like to, even if I didn't listen to this CD, collect like my favourite bands. I'll have all of their albums and collect them.
I like having CDs to let people borrow.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
It's not very nice when you say, oh, say I heard a great album, I'll write it onto a memory stick.
yeah.
I'll send it to an email.
Yeah.
It's nice to have the album and the box art and just give it to them.
Like the sentimental, like,
fact
of having something that you can touch is good. And then, like, cause that's the thing, there's always going to be a space for it. It might get smaller, but it's always going to exist. There's always going to be someone who wants all of this or wants a hard copy that you can look at physically in your house and have on a shelf.
Mm.
So it's always going to be there. It might get really small, but it will always be there. It's never going to go away. And then, again, like, it is good, like, just for lending, like, because I'd like to get them, especially if it's got, like, amazing artwork or whatever. I'll be like, the artwork's really great.
Lyrics.
Yeah, with the book inside, so you got the official lyrics, what they say, not what the internet says.
Yeah.
And then you can just, like, put that on yourself and then, lend it to people. Or.
And then if you're, like, clearing out your house in 20 years, you can look back and be like, oh, my favourite album, or like, oh no, ABBA, what was I thinking?
I know, and then it's not a case of turning on your ancient computer and trawling through the hard drive and finding music, it's just, you just put it in CD player and you're like, hey, it's like I'm years ago.
It's like I'm years ago. So, thinking about independent labels and independent music, are either of you a fan of that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Do you think that, I don't know, indie music nowadays is kind of, if someone says indie, it's like four guys that are a bit scruffy from England, like playing guitars.
Guitar bands,
yeah. Do you think that indie's kind of lost its meaning, or do you think not really, because the people who truly know what it means still listen to it?
Mm.
What do you think?
I don't know. In a way, it's sometimes nowadays more a feeling or
a
philosophy than what it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have bands that get signed but still keep their kind of indie reputation.
Yeah, totally. Like, because indie initially was just me independent, so it was regardless of genre. And then it kind of became with, I don't know, like Neutral Milk Hotel and stuff, and they kind of revolutionized the whole guitar band thing. Then onto Death Cab for Cutie, and then on, and it just snowballed into a massive thing. And then, it just became about, well, even way before that, like, The Clash and stuff, they're all, like, basically indie. That's, like, you know, the origins of indie. And it's all about the spirit of it, and about how it's, like, songwriting tied to guitar-based stuff. But now, it's pretty much regardless of whether they're independent or not, it's about the type of music they make.
I'd say that's becoming less true, because nowadays, like they're indie psych rock bands, they're indie electronica bands.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you link me some indie blues, pre-war blues.
Yeah, you list that.
Yeah.
Stone King. He's like in character, like blues from the
it's like Louis Armstrong or something.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's independent. It's
that's definitely indie. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah, because it is like it's hard to say. I say like for a long time it was tied down to like guitar based stuff, and then now it probably is coming out again. It's starting to change up because there's electro is becoming really big in like songwriting and stuff these days. Like with the Postal Service, they're like early there, yeah.
Folktronica.
Yeah, folktronica. And stuff like that, and it's totally changing up again, and that's becoming what indie is.
Do you ever, I don't know if it's just me, but do you ever get annoyed when you love a band and no one else really knows them, and then suddenly everyone loves them, and you'll see, like, people wearing their T-shirts, and they're in the charts and everything. Like, for example, the Arctic Monkeys, they're a band who, they became big because of MySpace, and they just used to upload tracks that they'd recorded themselves onto MySpace, and they got a lot of fans because they were good, and they were something that was quite fresh and quite new. And then they got signed, and their first album was really quite different, and it was interesting, and you could tell that they were just writing about their own lives and having a good time. And then their second album, they'd matured a bit more, but it was quite the same, and it was a bit more produced. And then their third album came out, and it was produced by Josh Homme. And
really?
Yeah, their third album was produced by Josh Homme, the one that was out recently.
Humbug, right?
Yeah, Humbug.
Humbug. That's
Josh Homme. So Josh Homme by Queens, from Queens of the Stone Age,
yeah.
And they've kind of. The whole album's completely different, which on its own would be fine because you'd be like, well, the band have matured, they've taken a new direction, but their whole image has changed, and now they're not like the cheeky young lads they were. They're just sort of trying to be this American rock star. And I saw them, and I was really excited to see them live. And one of their songs, Mardi Bum, which was one of the most popular ones when they came on MySpace, and it was a fan favourite, yeah. All the fans love it, and they played live, and they wouldn't play that song, and they were like, no, we're tired of it, and they didn't play any of their old songs, and they didn't really have any rapport with the crowd. They kind of ignored them. They played loads of stuff from Humbug, their new album, which had just came out, and no one knew the words yet, and they really let their fans in. I was quite disappointed that they'd kind of let everything go to their heads.
It was definitely, like with the Arctic Monkeys, it was quite weird, because like, cause they got their reputation before anyone, before most people, like, before the music industry had like listened to them properly. So again, it was all fans like in their hometown and stuff from MySpace and like LimeWire and Kazaa and stuff, and then Torrents as well. That they became really big through that before anyone knew who they were. And then when their album was released and stuff, the music in it is actually really good. Like they've got crazy chord progressions. They like take inspiration from the Beatles and stuff, and then make it thrashy with quite a lot of distortion and much more grassroots lyrics and stuff. And so the music was like pretty surprising, and again that was like indie back in the day. That was like their indie as well origins, but then they did that weird transition that other bands have done, like the Killers and Arcade Fire and some other bands. They're kind of from a grassroots indie to being lifted up to like stadium rock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
because that happened to the Killers, and like it's for a variety of reasons. But obviously if Josh Homme did their third album because they were big enough or whatever, then he's just, it's this surreal kind of jump between like being a wee band to get pretty big, then suddenly being stadium rock, and then musically they're aiming for that as well. Because the sound of Humbug is nothing like the first two albums.
Yeah.
Like, there's almost no thrashy stuff, or if there is, all like kind of quite restrained rock with lots of reverb and funny like sounds and that. And then again with Arcade Fire, the first album's like so grassroots, so organic. Then the second album's really big sound with high production values and really expansive noise, and the Killers as well from the first album onwards.
Yeah.
Getting bigger and bigger. Not necessarily better, but bigger.
Alistair, do you have any opinions of this, or have none of your bands made it big?
No, I have some opinions. I think a lot of it's got to do with how quickly a band grows. Like you were saying a few minutes ago, it's the same with everything. Books, movies, anything you enjoy on your own, and then other people start to enjoy it, you have this kind of niggling feeling that it's yours and they're stealing it. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be enjoying it.
Yeah, like Kings of Leon, they were like, when I was like 15, like they were my band, and I was like, yes. I knew loads of other people who felt the same way with that Shake Heartbreak. I listened to the first album a bit, it was really good, but Half Shape was like just my thing. It was like all I listened to for like the best part of a year. And then yeah, like the next album came out, and by then I kind of moved on, I was listening to other stuff, but I heard it was good, so I was like, okay, I'll give it a try. And it was just like, what's happened to their music? Like, from being quite full but not in your face and really listenable, even though it's still quite like fast paced and quite like rapid and energetic, it was still listenable and really enjoyable. And then the album after that, the third album, it's just like suddenly kind of spacious and slow, and I didn't like the lyrics, and I thought they repeated too many kind of sounds and themes. And then it became like, just as it went on, it just got worse and worse. I felt like it just became like some of the, like the first few seconds of a couple of songs on their fourth album are like the worst introductions I've ever heard to a song ever. It's like really rubbish guitar and bass riff that they repeat a few times. It's like, you don't need to hear this.
If a band changes too much too fast, like over the course of an album, it's almost as if some of the old fans can't like hang on.
Based on to me. Yeah. Because like, I just feel total kind of, not contempt, but just like kind of irritation at how that's what everyone knows them as. Like, if you say Kings of Leon to most people, like in, say, a club, they'll say, oh yeah, Sex is on Fire, woo! And I'm like, no, the old stuff, the old blues and the milk and stuff and the bucket.
It's like with Green Day, when I was about 10, I loved Green Day and I loved like Dookie and Kerplunk and all their old stuff. And then nowadays everyone's like, oh yeah, I love their first album, American Idiot, so good. Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Fight the Man. And I'm like, no.
It's like the fifth album or something.
Like, more than that.
Really?
I'm pretty sure.
They're an old band.
Yeah, they are really old. And in the 90s, I just loved them. They were so fun and kind of punky but poppy at the same time. And
they were fun, but they were still like relatively serious and deep as well.
Yeah,
like,
they were quite deep.
Their songs were deep. And then American Idiot is like pretty much no depth.
They just are trying to sort of move with the times and attract young people, which they have, so good for them, but I'm not interested. In general, do you think that music's changed much? I don't know, I just feel like loads of bands these days are really manufactured and they're made to sound a certain way. And as you were saying, I know this is like a terrible example of good music, but McFly's new song Party Girl, it's got a sort of whoa, but that's like Lady Gaga.
Oh, yeah.
Like with Kings of Leon, Sex on Fire, and then the other one called, the slower one, it's
which
like
one?
whoa, that one,
I can't remember, I don't even know.
Loads of songs these days have the same kind of thing and they all sound really similar. And
use,
I don't know, maybe.
Be Somebody or Use Somebody?
Be Somebody.
Yeah,
use somebody.
Yeah. Be Somebody is
the enemy. The enemy, yeah. I don't know, I just feel like a lot of music is like that now, but I guess it might have been the same.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, like, music's always going to be self-referential. It's always like whatever the writer listened to back in the day or whatever they're a fan of. But, like, when it comes to the chart, it's self-referential, as in producers think, this is what's in right now, like Lady Gaga or whatever. So they'll pick up the kind of like modes or the kind of scales they use in that music and imprint it onto other stuff, like McFly's one. Their kind of their vocal pit and the bit in the backing is so similar to that Lady Gaga song. And it feels directly like a producer has gone, this will make people like it because it will remind them subconsciously of Lady Gaga, like that's what they're into. So.
But I think it has to be hard when there's been so much music in the world to come up with new things. Like CeeLo Green, his new single, I'll say Forget You because the real name's quite rude. It's quite, I don't know, like it's a good song and he's really good, but then it reminds me so much of like a Sugar Babe song. And I don't think he has been like, oh, I'll rip this song, but then obviously it's just hard to come up with really fresh stuff.
That song's weird. Yeah, it's like, that's a really generic song as well. Like, the backing track, it's just so, it's like sold pretty generically. But if you listen to Gnarls Barkley, they're like the opposite of generic, because it's him and Danger Mouse trying to do new stuff with pop and with vocals and everything.
That's what I like with stand-up comedians, that kind of conditioning thing. Mm-hmm. Like the bit where the comedian puts on a blank face and looks at the crowd, you're expected to laugh.
Yeah.
You've been trained, when he does this thing, he's just said something funny. When they do this chord switch, when they modulate, you're expected to like it.
Yeah,
it's true. And that will fluctuate. It will always be the same kind of conditioning, where they're trying to make you feel a certain way or remind you of something, but it'll be different as the years go on. Different things they're trying to remind you of.
Do you know what they did in the 90s? And I really, really miss it. Whenever you used to watch CD UK or anything on the telly, Westlife would all be on stools, and then in the chord change they'd all stand up and you'd be like, oh, it's so emotional. And it was so good. I miss that.
Powerful men.
Yeah.
Singing.
That was definitely a thing of the 90s.
What you said about attracting kids, I saw a great quote about Placebo. One of the guys in the position saying, I love this. I mean, I keep getting older, but the fans stay the same age.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah, I think that's really the same with, like, Green Day. One band, not biased because they're my favourite band ever, but Blink-182 started off, like, with Buddha and Cheshire Cat, their first albums and EPs. It was, like, so, like, thrashy, really awful vocals, like, rah, singing away, and it was awful, but it was really good at the same time. And then they progressed on to, like, Take Off Your Pants and Jacket, Enema of the State, and it was a bit more mature, but it was still, like, really silly songs, like, talking about teenage things. And then with their self-titled album, Blink-182, they had just matured so much. The music was amazing on it. They had, like, the guy from The Cure with all the crazy makeup. And they were still singing about things that, like, an older teenager would relate to, maybe a young adult. And now, obviously, that was the last album they had, but now when you see them live, they do sort of relate to my age group, and it's as if I've grown up with them, even though they're, like, older men now. But they have kind of, they've progressed as their fans have, and I think that's really good.
That's true.
Well, thank you both for coming in. Thank you, Alex.
No problem.
Thank you, Alistair. I do have to apologise for the strange noise that comes and goes. That's the washing machine, which you'll be able to hear really loudly. Also, Alex has been munching on a box of Pringles, and you can hear that really loudly. Thank you for listening, and I hope we've given you something to think about.
Bye-bye. Bye.